OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties, one county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in that home straight, trying to catch that bold spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7.30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.
Okay, for Wednesday night rugby this evening, we have with us Rory O'Connor from the Irish Independent. Rory, how you doing?
Good, Joe, thanks.
And we have Matt Williams all the way from France. Matt, hello.
Hello, Joey. Hey, Rory, how you all doing there? Good to be with you.
Great to have you with us. We should be reflecting on a Heineken Champions Cup final in Marseille, which would have happened on Saturday. Who would have won, Matt?
Oh, gee, Joey, you know, that's nothing like an easy one in confinement to be hit with straight off. Look, I think Saracens, whoever won out of Saracens and Leinster would have won the Heineken Cup. I probably fancy Saracens to just stick it up to everyone in their last hurrah. But, you know, we'll never know. We'll never know.
We never will. And actually, quick look ahead. We're going to have a catch-all look at the state of rugby in Ireland and for the EPCR at the moment. But with the ideal schedule coming up, Rory, in the autumn, they're planning still to try and finish the Heineken Champions Cup. A lot of Saracens players will have left by then. The likes of Liam Williams, Skelton, George Cruz, I think Maitland. There's a whole bunch, obviously, given their financial situation and the relegation. So they're not there come quarter-final time when it does happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there'll be a championship club by then. So if things go, you know, because the Champions Cup final, it takes place after the new Pro 14 season begins, in theory, which is just weird. Like Munster will be going into this with Damien D'Allende and RG Snyman on board. So, you know, they've played a Pro 14 without them, and now suddenly they go into the run-in and, you know, two games and playoffs, if it all happens, with an unbelievably stacked squad, and like instantly narrows the gap between them and Leinster, which makes life a bit more interesting. But whether it's, you know, equitable or fair, you'd wonder. And yeah, Saracens will not be the force that, you know, if I agree with Matt, if it had gone ahead as planned, even at the Aviva, I think they could have taken Leinster. It would have been, like, I was really looking forward to that game. And, you know, I don't think anyone was going to stop them from there. But, yeah, you take out a couple of players, you rip the soul out of it, and you'd wonder whether they'll be as strong. But I guess we'll be glad of it if there's any sort of rugby at that stage.
Yeah, it's true. Matt, I know the last dispatch I heard from France was that there would be no professional sport until September. They came out with that quite early on in this whole situation. How are things looking there now? Has there been a fall in numbers contracting the virus? The numbers here are quickly improving.
Yeah, a bit the same, Joe. We opened up 10 days ago. You know, I could get out of your village, get out of your town and go for a walk on the beach or in a forest or a park. Well, the parks are still closed where I am, but it's certainly opened up a lot. Cafes and restaurants open next Monday, I think. And there hasn't been a huge spike in what's a second wave, if you like, but everyone's holding back. I think the real hard part for this part of Europe, the southern part, is the summer and what's going to happen with the massive migration of people coming down from the north. Will they come? Numbers certainly will come. What's going to happen in Spain and southern France that are basically tourist central? I think the second division, the Pro de Deux here, has been smashed, as has the lower divisions of Federale. Certainly talk coming out of some clubs in top 14 is of dire financial troubles. We're just really not hearing all the truth of the pictures in there. There's hope that they'll get these games going, but there is some talk that they won't. I've been told by one guy who's a club official, a Leeds club official, that there is a chance that it will still be not going in September, because of the need, entrepreneurs of rugby, of the collisions, of the travel, inter-travel between different parts, because what they're looking at is if there's an outbreak in, say, Lyon, then Lyon will be shut down. They won't shut down the whole country, but that what happens if it's Lyon and Toulon that are shut down at the same time? What happens to the competition? Like, it's incredibly complicated, and I really feel for the officials, because they're trying to deal with facts they don't have. The things in France were very, very bad, especially in the north, the Parisian area and the area to the east of that. But the rugby heartland wasn't hit as hard. But I don't know if that's going to make any difference in the long run to the ability to get the games going.
And when it comes to the finances at play, I saw the French top 14 chief executive, Paul Gotze. He was talking about a tsunami of clubs going to the wall without government support. Yeah. Obviously, it's a different system over here. I had just wondered, would all the rich club owners pick up the tab and French club rugby would be able to move on?
It's the unknown question, Joe. Bernard Laporte a few weeks ago suggested there might have been 6 or 7 clubs where that was the case. But it depends on what business that the owner's in. Yeah. If he's copped a shellacking through the last 3 months, he mightn't have the cash flow to do it. The French clubs are very lucky in that they are on the equivalent of the dole of unemployment benefits. It's called the chômage. But the crazy system in France is they pick up 80% of your wage. They don't pay you a set figure. They pick up a percentage of your wage. So the French clubs, players and coaches have been, if you like, isolated from this and the clubs. So they've only had to drop 20%. And even then, some of the players aren't agreeing to drop 20% of their wages. There's been, you know, I think some pretty selfish behaviour by a number of people in not preparing to take any sort of haircut in this crisis. Now, the government has also said they're going to stop that. That's going to finish in a few months and they have to stand on their own 2 feet, right. Which I think is quite right. They've been given the amount of the volume of money they've been given compared to the rest of the community, many of them being not foreigners as well. So it's a very complex business situation. But, mate, the bottom line of all this, Joe, is that outside of Ireland, the English and the French business models for how they structured their club rugby never worked, and now they're exposed. And many of them will fail. Now, I don't think that's such a bad thing in the long run, because the way they were going about business was just wrong. It was affecting the game around the world, especially in Ireland, but it just couldn't hold. And if some of them have to fall, and by that they won't disintegrate, they might drop down divisions or they might have to restructure. For the good of the game, I think that might be a very good thing.
Meanwhile, here at home, Rory, we've had Philip Brown in the last week and more recently Mick Dawson talking about the situation. There were 12,800 season tickets sold from a Leinster point of view last season, some for as much as €750. So we are talking about millions here. That is now all gone, just wiped off. There's some kind of membership scheme, I think. So if tickets come online, you'll be a priority customer to buy those tickets. But even that, you know, that line in the sand, no season tickets going on sale, 12,800 season tickets sold last season. Dawson was pretty frank. Like, this is not something Leinster can sustain.
No, I don't think any professional sporting organisation can sustain themselves, particularly in the environment rugby operates, where TV money is not that lucrative beyond a couple of months in this scenario. And Philip Brown, like on Friday, Philip Brown did his first press conference since the sport was locked down. And, you know, he was fairly frank. He was forthright. There was parts of it that were, you know, that you kind of left going, that's pretty good. That sounds good. We're going to get back. And yet there's nagging doubts. And over the weekend, probably those doubts creep up even more. You start asking questions or you look at the answers that he gave and there's vagueness, you know, a completely appropriate vagueness because he doesn't know the answers to them. They basically put a line in the sand to say, this is what we're working towards. But they need government approval to do that. They need, like, the Premiership in England currently is at a standstill because they don't know what happens if one player tests positive. But the RFU said, we need a date to work towards. We need a start point for training. And then on Monday, Mick Dawson and Leinster come out, I think it was on Monday, and they cancel season ticket sales for next year, citing social distancing, just saying you can't have a full RDS as a result of social distancing. And, you know, a lot of this stuff we kind of know, but it's when it's actually decided and it's announced and it's black and white that you kind of take a breath and you realise how stark this is going to be. You know, we can all watch the games behind closed doors and you know, Bundesliga has been fine. It's not, you know, what you signed up for, but it's better than nothing. But from a business model perspective, it's pretty bleak. The RFU will lose between 15 and 20 million euro this year if there's no Six Nations refixtures and no November games. That figure is between 10 and 15 if it goes ahead behind closed doors. So, you know, it's not that big a difference. And if the cost of testing is prohibitive, which it may well prove to be, you wonder what's the point. So, you know, part of you wonders what's the point in going ahead at all. So you've got that at play as well. So, like, they're still working through that. He hasn't got a firm figure on what testing will cost. He doesn't know if players will have to sign a waiver before they come back. He doesn't even know if the government will give them permission. But they have to plan to do something, because if they do nothing, their losses will be worse. But again, behind closed doors doesn't solve much for them.
Did Brown talk about players' salaries, Rory?
Yes, he did. He said, you know, they're in discussions with Rugby Players Ireland. You know, they took a haircut of between 10 and 50% at 5-0. That was a mistake I made when I heard it first. I thought it was 10 and 15 and reported it as such, because whoever told me was, I misheard them, but it was 10 and 50. The top earners like Johnny Sexton and Conor Murray got that 50%. And the lower earners, the younger players, the, you know, administrative staff, all of those people would have got the 10%. And that was supposed to be temporary. It sounds like it sounds less and less like that would be temporary. At some stage, they will have to review their wage structure, but they're talking to the Players Union, Rugby Players Ireland, about that. And I guess they're waiting on news as to when they can go back. And, you know, at what point, like I saw today, Leo Varadkar said that we might accelerate our phases, you know, that the things are good at the moment. Mm-hmm. Things could come back quicker. That 22nd of April or of August, they could come back. We just don't know yet. But yeah, I think cuts are on the way. I don't think that's in any doubt, really, because if your income is down that much, there's only so much you can do to keep the wolves from the door before you start looking at your own cost base.
Yeah. I saw someone quit to him in the Zoom or the Microsoft Teams conference, whatever version of all this was used, that, you know, one of the cheaper things you could do is have players leave the country and be paid by somebody else. And he sort of, you know, joked himself and said, that is true. Who knows if something like that happens, Matt? I mean, if your wages are being cut by a percentage like that, and say there are one or two rich French or English owners who can pay your wages, then maybe that becomes more of a reality. It's one of the other unknowns in all this.
Joe, I think one of the things that's striking me is, in these times, you need people with really nimble thinking, really people that think out of the square. So tomorrow, Australian Rugby League recommences. The rounds come back now. While everyone that's listening here in Ireland, you know, they're not familiar or don't care really about rugby league, and I fully understand that. My point is, it's a very similar sport to rugby. It's contact. It's a big competition. It's been stood down because of the virus, and they've come back. I really do not understand why people are not doing case studies on what these other contact sports are doing, how they've got to the point they are. Now, we have to say Australia and New Zealand are a long way in front of Europe as far as they have not been impacted anywhere near as much as Europe with the Corona-19. It just hasn't happened. But they are back playing. Now, there is absolutely no reason for Ireland to not use that as a case study and say, how do we do that? How do we go about it? There are no people at games, but they're back playing, and that gives them some cash flow. Players are taking a haircut with their wages. Everyone's taking a haircut with their wages. But they've got it back on board, and they're going back to full competition tomorrow. AFL, Australian rules, will follow in, I think, a month. Now, don't quote me on that. I think it's mid-June, late June that they're starting. Don't quote me, but in a short period of time. Now, I said before in the Irish Times, look, you need people to be able to think, to maybe take games to Australia to a safe environment. But the trick is to get cash coming in the door. Now, the chairman of the Australian Rugby League, Peter Volandis, has been banging down doors of government, been headbutting people to get it going. He's copped a lot of criticism, but his job is to get the game going, and he's done that. And I just think in Europe, We're still looking at that. The game schedule that Philip Brown put out the other day was like the old days. We're going to have a game in Marseille, then we're going to play in Italy a national game in Rome against Italy, then we're going to play another game. I just can't see us being able to skip countries. Is that safe for the players? They're thinking on the paradigm before the virus. And the solution to this is coming up with new paradigms. Now, I'm not in those boardrooms and I don't have all the facts in front of me to say, look, we should do X, Y, and Z. But I certainly know that thinking the way we're still thinking, as in back in February, that's not going to solve our problems. The problems are still going to exist if we do that.
If people haven't seen the schedule that they're hoping for in an ideal world, it is Interpros on the final two weekends of August at the Aviva Stadium. Then Pro 14 semi-finals. Then they want to have the Champions Cup quarterfinals. Then they'll have a Pro 14 final. Then they'll have the Champions Cup semi-finals by the end of September. And then into the next month, October, we'll have the two postponed Six Nations games against Italy at home and France in Paris. And then you'll have the Pro 14 season starting. And then you'll have the Champions Cup final. And then you'll be into international games across October, November with the likes of South Africa, I think it's Japan and Australia, all due to arrive. And that includes three French clubs in the last eight. That includes South African travel, Australian travel, Japanese travel. Hopeful? Is that the euphemism we're using, Matt, for that kind of a schedule?
Oh, wow. You know, I really want the games to go ahead. You don't want to see rugby any sport or the world where we are. And we all need a distraction, for sure. Just the community needs something to smile about. But, you know, why do it? Why not say, listen, boys, we're in real trouble now. We've got this thing killing everyone. Let's try and think of a way we can do it. It might be Ireland saying, we're a safe zone. We are the safe zone. Play the games here. Come over 14 days beforehand. We'll put you into lockdown. We'll test the two rooms and we'll play at Thurman Park. We'll play at Croke Park. We'll play at Lansdowne Road at the Aviva. You know, but there is jumping on planes and going from one country to the other, bringing teams over from the south. I mean, Australians aren't allowed to travel to Europe. They're just not allowed to travel. That's just not going to happen. Japan has still got the pandemic is still very, very deep in Japan. You just can't see them being allowed to jump on a plane and jump off in Paris and say, oh, we're all happy. That's how this whole thing started. Mm. Now, you know, that's what I'm saying. We need wisdom and a new paradigm of thinking. To me, that schedule, I really hope I'm wrong because I want rugby to start. I just can't see that schedule possibly being fulfilled because of the pandemic.
Did you get a sense from Philip Brown, Rory, in the press conference that he was fully aware of how, I don't use the word unlikely, but let's use it, unlikely that schedule is?
He certainly wasn't portraying that sense, but, you know, as the questions flowed in and it was an hour-long briefing, there was a lot of questions he wasn't fully able to answer as of yet. And I think Matt, you know, everything Matt says is eminently sensible. And once you start thinking about it, and once you start reading, you know, beyond the sports pages and what's going on elsewhere, even the day that Philip Brown gave his briefing was the same day that Tony Holohan spoke about the fact that people who arrive in Ireland will have to self-isolate in a hotel or in a centre for 2 weeks on arrival. And Brown was asked about that and he said, well, we hope that they'll consider international sports people in a different light, that they're already in some sort of a bubble. But, you know, the Irish government, they're not going to, you know, there's an awful lot of trust involved in that, and saying that these people, these sports people have spent 2 weeks completely unexposed to the virus, that they come in, and, you know, there's just steps there that they're going to have to get across government that are so hard to do. And I guess what it does is it exposes the weakness of only having four professional teams. At one point, you know, I argued the case that if international travel becomes a problem, why not have an expanded AIL, get the professional players that we have here in across the different squads, and give, you know, basically pick your top eight clubs on provincial lines, get the provincial players into the clubs and have a different kind of competition, just something different that you can sell to a broadcaster, and you play here because international travel is going to be so difficult. And aligning all of those borders, we've seen what's going on in the UK this week. I mean, the chances that they're going to be in lockstep with us, you know, if you could, then you'd have a British and Irish competition, brilliant, but the chances of them being in lockstep with us, the chances of Italy, France, Australia not having a second wave at a critical point. I mean, you know, if there's an outbreak, if there's one case in the squad the week of the Champions Cup final, it throws the whole thing off. And that's where, once you start digging into it, you see the risks. At least in New Zealand, they have a model that is New Zealand teams playing against New Zealand teams in a country that has effectively extinguished the virus. And they can confidently go about that. And the quality of teams and the number of teams just about justifies it. You know, but it might get boring after, you know, once they've completed the first one, if they can't play anyone else, because they, you know, it's still only five teams, but they do have the Mitre 10 Cup to go to. you know, I think we need to, I think Matt's right, we need to be creative. If it is welcoming all these teams to Ireland and having the bubble here and the government are okay with that, brilliant. Because, you know, like I want the sport to come back. But if it's just doing it ourselves because our government have approved it and travel is an issue, then maybe we need to be creative about what we do and we come up with something a bit different.
Yeah. What about, Matt, there were suggestions, for instance, that they may have to look at the actual mechanics of the game, i.e. no mauls, no scrums, in a way to make it safer. There is a tipping point when you start meddling with laws like that in the game.
There is. It's a very interesting topic. It's also beautifully rugby. It's been suggested to me that under the guise of the virus, there's a certain group within World Rugby that I would support that want to change a few things, and here's our chance. I mean, the scrums are a blight in the game. The resets will take 3 minutes. I know how much you love the scrums, Joe, but they are a terrible blight on the game because they take so long to form. There was one stage there in the World Cup final where after the referee had blown his whistle and called for a scrum, it was 40 seconds till the South African hooker actually got to the mark and put his hands up just to form the scrum. Mm. Now, that has to change. And they're saying, OK, we won't have – there's no reset scrums. They also said there's no – well, they call face-to-face tackle, so I'm not – I can't come in with my face next to your face. I have to come in low. You know, there's certainly been a push to bring in the low tackles. It's been resisted by the elite end because that if you come in with a low tackle, it means I've got my hands free and I can offload, which is beautiful for the spectator, but, you know, it makes it hard for the defence. Who cares? Bring it in. And the 50-20 kick, which would means if I kick the ball out on the bounce behind my halfway mark, I get the line out. Now, they're the things they want to bring in, and I support them. And this is some way of doing it. Because, and there's no doubt, when you're in a maul or a scrum, you know, the body contact is, for those guys in there, is extraordinary. And to minimise that, and especially if you're thinking getting down the lower levels of the game, I think that's a really, really positive thing. But there's always the law of unintended consequences, especially when you throw these things in without trial. Now, a lot of these other aspects have been trialed. So it's an interesting one, Joe. I'm not so sure it's got real legs. And I think it's thrown out there to see what the reaction would be. The problem in the long term with getting away with scrums is it changes the physiques of the guys. There's some pluses in that. It means the game will become much faster, so it would be much more aerobic. The bigger, bulky physiques would need to be reduced because the aerobic requirements would jump. But it would also, at the lower levels, take away from, you know, the little guy at primary school who's squat, he's no good at basketball, he's no good at GAA, he's no good at football, he's not fast enough, he hasn't got his endurance. But gee whiz, he's important in rugby because he's strong and can hold up a scrum. Mm. For those things, I don't want to see that change. So it's as you say, you've got to be very, very careful when we go in for this. If they made the laws and said, look, this is just for professional rugby, okay, you know, I could see that. But I wouldn't like to see that going down to the under-16s and so on.
What are you hearing on that front, Rory?
Pretty much what you were saying yourself, Joe. I mean, I think the no scrums, no mauls thing was a bit of a flyer that came out over the weekend. It's been kind of watered down to a reduction, as Matt said, because of so basically to get rid of reset scrums, and they reckon that will bring down the risk of transition by 30%, because the average exposure time for second rows and props is 13.4 minutes. So you bring that down to, I think, below 10 minutes if you reduce resets. So like that makes sense. It does invite the idea that you just, if you're a weaker, like England in the World Cup final, you just collapse and give them a free kick and deal with it. And I know the World Cup final, there was a lot of resets, and I don't understand, like I played in the front five, I don't understand why it takes so long to set up a scrum. It doesn't make any sense. Maybe if the thread is hanging over front rows and scrum coaches, they might speed up, because really there's no reason that they all take a big long break and you know, look at each other for so long. Just get in there and push. That's just, like, that would easily fix most of the problems. If you put a timer on it, maybe that'd be good. But anyway, so the other thing is, yeah, the high tackles, they think that will bring down the risk of exposure by 20%. So like that, you can see why they're doing that. I think what they're going to do is they're going to bring that in this week through the executive committee of World Rugby. But it will be basically an option for any union to take. So if the Irish government are pushing back against rugby coming back as a whole, the IRFU can then say, well, what if we did this? This is how we feel it will reduce the numbers. And maybe then NFET or whoever's making that decision will go, well, look, you've brought down the acceptable risk to us. But in New Zealand, because the risk of transmission is so low, because basically the virus has been stamped out there, they don't need to do that. It's probably, you know, it's not a one size fits all for rugby across the world. And they do say it is temporary, but I think Matt's right. It suits them to get rid of resets. It suits them to get rid of high tackles. That they're two of the things they're hot on anyway. So I think they're probably a little bit of trying to get, you know, see what this could be their trial for those things to kind of push them forward, because they want to reduce concussions and they want to speed up the game.
So you played in the front five. Were you one of the young lads who was no good at anything that Matt was talking about then?
I'm an old lad who's no good at anything now. I certainly wasn't small though.
Yeah.
It wasn't my problem.
It's endlessly complicated. Even Barry O'Driscoll, Dr. Barry O'Driscoll, was in the paper in the Mail 2 weeks ago, and he was saying, look, where does it end? Because even just the fact that, unlike soccer, the players have that ball in their hands at all times, and it's pass, pass, pass. I mean, you're all more than wiping the same surface. Do you disinfect the balls at every break and play? So it's a particularly complicated game to bring back. I mean, there's no solution to that, Matt. We got to pass the ball.
No, you're right, Joe. Again, you know, I would look down at what Australian Rugby League is doing, because the Australian reports on outbreaks in Australia have dropped dramatically as well. Like, Australia is opening up and is really doing well. They've had just on 100 deaths, you know, across the size of a continent the size of America with 25 million people. You know, they've managed. Well, Sydney is still a hotspot because it's a people thing, and Sydney's a big place. And Melbourne also, but they test the guys every day. Their temperatures come in. They have all these protocols, how they change. If they've got a temperature, they don't come in the door. Anyone that's tested and goes positive, you know, the whole team is shut down. There's a whole lot of protocols they put in place. And so far, after a month of training, they haven't had one outbreak, haven't had one report from within the entire competition, which is 16 teams. So this is not impossible to do. It's impossible to do, you know, at the depths of New York when the outbreak was at its peak. Yes, obviously you're not going to go and do that. But sure. when it's dropping to the point it is now, as long as you put in these smart protocols, there is a way of bringing it back. Well, I'm not going to tell you the way to do it because I'm not the expert, but this is what we need to do. You can bring it back. And look, at a point we must, for all our sanity, must start playing sport again. We need to do it, not just as spectators, but people need to play. We can't rob an entire generation of their ability to get out and enjoy playing sport. But now we need to do these things post-virus, just like the way we plan the senior games and the professional games post-virus. We have to think of a way where the local junior clubs get out and play. Like, in Rory's idea about getting the AIL and bringing them out is absolutely sensational idea. I think that's a fabulous idea. But then we would still need to have those protocols in place for the AIL clubs to train and play with. They would be the same protocols as if it was Leinster or Munster. So, and they're not impossible to do.
Okay. Two last quick points. Penny for Andy Farrell's thoughts right now, Matt, as the coach in the room here. Can he use this time in a very productive way? Is it just sit in your hands, don't worry about it? Talk to players, don't talk to players. There's no precedent for him to work off as such in terms of best practice.
Well, he'd be exceptionally frustrated. You imagine, you know, as this generation of players are, you know.
I'd say Johnny Sexton is looking at the clock every few hours.
Exactly.
Saying, this is valuable time.
None of us are getting these days back. And if this is your, you know, you think of the Olympic athletes. You know, some of them mightn't make next year. Some of them mightn't make the time next year. They've done 4 years of training. Their times were made. They mightn't be ready for next year. And Andy Farrell, you know, he's not going to tour Australia. He didn't get a play in Paris. He didn't get a play in Rome. You know, look, he'd be exceptionally frustrated. Now, he'd be talking to his players, but when you're in social isolating and no one can gather as a national coach, yeah, you can do a bit of planning and you can do – there are things, obviously, you are doing. But there's – you know, it's a game. You're not out there doing it. And this was his time. You know, this would be the time the boys are getting ready to go to Australia and, you know, they get to play in these wonderful venues. And I know Andy Farrell's been out there as a player himself in rugby league and played at them. And they're just great days for everyone involved, exceptional days. they're playing the Sydney, were going to play the Sydney Cricket Ground for the first time since 1979 when Ireland beat Australia and Kieran Fitzgerald was captain. I mean, this was going to be a once in a lifetime opportunity that seems to be gone. So I could just imagine the disappointment that he's feeling. And I feel it for all those boys, especially the Johnny Sextons of the world that are coming to the end of their time. Now they mightn't get any games. You don't know.
Rory, it's always great when you catch up on a former player and they're doing something which is a bit surprising. You did that in the Irish Independent recently. Eric Miller, it was a great piece. You might tell people what he's up to.
Yeah, I rang him. I mean, Matt knows Eric better than I do. He would have coached him, but I knew he had an interesting story to tell. I know Rory Keane from the Mail had talked to him about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years. And I remember hearing you guys talking about it on the paper review, and he was on my list of people to talk to at some stage after, you know, a bit of time had passed. So I rang him last week and I asked him what he was up to now. He had been coaching C Point and CUS, the school in town. And he said, no, I gave up coach. You know, I don't coach them anymore. I'm actually working in a nursing home. So I kind of stumbled upon this nugget of information that's obviously very topical. And he's a very interesting, very thoughtful guy. He's, you know, he's after retiring, he turned to God. He's very, very committed Christian, I guess. And that guides his way of living. He coached in Sri Lanka for a period, and his wife volunteered at an orphanage, or they visited an orphanage, and I met this young orphan girl with cerebral palsy, and they ended up adopting her and bringing her back to Ireland, and then doing a fundraising drive to get her surgery that she needed so that she could walk effectively, and they've gone through that in Derry County Offaly. And Eric now commutes three times a week to a nursing home in North Dublin, and you know, works with people who one of their only points of contact. You know, he works with kind of Brazilian and Eastern European women and men who have no idea that he was a 1997 Lion, that he was, you know, such a really unbelievable rugby player with a high profile once upon a time. He's just Eric who works with them, and it was really enjoyable talking to him. It was a really touching one. It was a very quotes heavy piece because he's a very articulate guy. He was well able to tell his own story and, you know, just kind of let it run. And thankfully at the moment we've lots of space to fill. So it's when you get talking to someone that interesting, you're able to do it. It was nice to be able to tell his story. I know he was happy enough with the piece, and, you know, like there was bits of it even about his own career that I wasn't able to get in, even saying that, like, he was telling me how he turned up in his Banjax car at Leicester at the age of 19 and asked him, could he join the first team? You know, that's the way rugby was in 1996. You could just turn up at Welford Road and within 18 months, he was a Lion. So, like, he's a really interesting guy, worth having on at some stage.
Yeah. I didn't get the sense he missed the cutthroat nature of rugby.
No. He was well able for it. Like, he was a class player. I know injury probably disrupted his career after the 97 Lions tour, and obviously he famously got sent off in that Celtic League win, you know, I think 2001. And, you know, he played 47, 48 times for Ireland. He probably could have played more. He reckons he could have gone on, but he retired at 30 because he just had fallen out of love with it a bit. But yeah, he's got, I mean, I hate the word perspective. It's thrown around too much, but he is a man who seems to have a great perspective on things, like to stay in the amateur game afterwards. He coaches Eden Derry in the Leinster League, loves working with those players, as a club man now. Yeah, it's just interesting. Like, the guys who played in that era, because they kind of came, professionalism was new. They've lived a bit more of a life than the current pros, I think. They've got more of a story to tell. So it was really nice to talk to them. And I suppose the benefit of this period is that we're getting to tell them more, you know, probably more nuanced, more interesting stories, and we're given a bit more space to do it.
Yeah, you'd obviously know Matt from your time.
Yeah, I coached Jared for 3 years. Yeah, he was one of the most talented footballers I've ever coached. He could do anything. He is, you know, very, very big athletic man. Could kick both. He was a very good GAA player, very good footballer. Could kick both feet. Great mind. Understood the game incredibly well. Didn't always articulate it that well, but he was a footballer, as you say. We had a back row. You had Victor Coslow at number 8, Keith Gleeson open side, and Eric Miller, this incredibly gifted athlete at 6 that could catch and pass off both hands, could kick both feet. He was as skillful as any back in the competition. And he was a lovely guy. But Eric was always, he was always different like that. He was not materialistic. He was not obsessive about things like that. He was just a really gifted athlete who adored the game. You know, it was a pleasure to be around. I always got on great with Eric.
Okay. Well, listen, on that note, Rory O'Connor, thanks so much as ever. Matt Williams, thanks, good Matt. To talk to you, Matt. We'll talk to you soon.
See you, Joe.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.